Welcome to CICK News, the only news source in the North truly dedicated to local stories on the ground. CICK News addresses the diverse needs of the underserved communities between Burns Lake and Haida Gwaii through firsthand stories and in-depth interviews. CICK News funding is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially support campus and community radio stations in Canada, as well as the Government of Canada. We are your hosts, Pam Hassan and Dan Messick, and we are on the dial at 93.9 FM, Smithers Community Radio. Our call letters are CICK, and we are broadcasting from the unceded Gitindam territory, home of the Wet'suwet'en Nation. Follow CICK News online at smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook or Instagram at Smithers Community Radio.
Today on CICK News, in 2004, after years of searching for the perfect rural property, Ray Chipanik and Sonia Sawchuk found their forever home on a piece of land just south of Smithers. They expanded a large network of forest trails and gardens, expecting to enjoy the property throughout their retirement and build a home to spend the rest of their lives. But a few years after they purchased their slice of paradise in northwest BC, a huge swath of forest upriver was auctioned off by BC Timber Sales, the provincial crown corporation which allocates about 20% of BC's annual allowable cut to private logging companies each year. The cut block in question upstream was part of a large watershed which encompassed the property. The cut block was auctioned off and about 30% of the watershed was logged in 2009. Although Chipanik and Sawchuk advocated to BC Timber Sales to investigate downriver impacts from logging 30% of the watershed, their calls went unanswered and the trees came down. In 2012, the property flooded for the first time. Soon after, Chipanik and Sawchuk knew they needed to investigate the cause of the flooding, and they were sure it was due to the logging. So they hired UBC forest management researcher and hydrologist Dr. Yonis Alila to initiate a report that would eventually find that logging 30% of a watershed was enough to destabilize the tree canopy that usually absorbs most of the snow that falls in the area, which now was absorbed into the ground, increasing the hydrological flows downstream, which would lead to the flooding. In 2014, Chipanik and Sawchuk launched a lawsuit against the provincial government and associated logging operations, which led to the flooding, seeking damages of $300,000 for ecological grief as well as loss in property value. Finally, after nearly 8 years, at the 11th hour, just before the trial was to begin, government lawyers handed Chipanik and Sawchuk's attorney, Ian Lawson, a handwritten note agreeing to settle the case for $300,000. The logging company, Triantha Enterprises, was also named a defendant in the lawsuit, which agreed to an earlier settlement, however, the details of which are under a confidentiality agreement. Although Chipanik and Sawchuk received financial compensation, it pales in comparison to the distress and impairment to the property they hope to spend their retirement on. A settlement alone in this case as well is not as powerful as a judgment. If the case had gone to trial, it could have set a precedent for future cases of the same nature, possibly one of the reasons why the government chose to settle. However, Chipanik, Sawchuk, and their lawyer Ian Lawson hope that this story encourages other property owners experiencing similar issues to approach the situation in the same fashion. Today, we speak with attorney Ian Lawson about the intricacies of the lawsuit, how it came to be in the first place, and why it ended the way it did. Stay with us.
It's Ian Lawson. I'm at my office in Smithers.
Thanks so much for being with us, Ian. There are some major intricacies with this case over a long period of time. Perhaps you can give us a brief about the origins of this case and how it came to be.
Right. Well, there are a couple of very fine people, retired here. They shopped really carefully for an ideal wilderness property. And they, after several years of hunting, they found an ideal property. It was 160 acres, pretty much wild, with some trails on it. They built more trails and they intended to retire there, cross-country ski, hike through the forests. They then heard that the timber auction was going to happen in the watershed, Hunniker watershed, and immediately they started communicating with BC Timber Sales saying, You better check the downstream effects, because they were planning to log a watershed, and they were downstream from the watershed. Their concerns were pretty much ignored, and just like a nightmare, here we are on Halloween talking about it. A nightmare then unfolded because their concerns were ignored. The watershed was logged, and within a few years, they started to be flooded, and still are flooded. And so their enjoyment of the property was severely damaged. That's a nutshell.
I guess, Ian, you know, when this suit, when they first came and approached you about, you know, pursuing the suit, what were some of the merits of the case that you researched and won on? I know we just chatted earlier before we started this, and you mentioned that there was a strong case. Maybe tell me a little bit about those merits that you felt made up the strong case.
Well, we would not have had a hope without a strong expert opinion. And so to my client's credit, they actually located and contacted a professor of hydrology, forest hydrology at UBC, Dr. Alila. And the result of that, eventually we received a very strong and clear report that in this particular watershed, even if you logged 30% of the coniferous trees, which is what happened, the impact on the hydrology was dramatic, because it was a pretty flat watershed. Snow doesn't stay in the trees as it normally does, because the trees are gone. Snow lands on the ground and it melts all at once in the right temperature. And so flooding was the result. And so after that opinion, in my view, it became a pretty open and shut case.
Now, this case was initiated some time ago, about 8 years ago in 2014. What was the initial kind of read from the government when you started this? Why did it take so long to get to this point?
Well, the first issue is that the flooding happened in 2012. Their first incident of flooding happened in 2012, and the logging happened in 2009. So by the point that severe problems were arising, my clients tried their best to work things out. They filed a complaint with the Forest Practices Board, didn't really achieve anything, and so there's a two-year limitation to file a claim, and so by the time they came to see me, it was pretty close to 2014, and so we filed. Then, of course, we had to find proper proof, and it took a while to retain Dr. Alila, and then also to get his report. I don't think we had his report until 2018, 2019, something like that. So it took a while, and then, of course, there's regular court delay.
Why do you think the government finally came back to you with agreeing to the settlement? And as I understand it, in a pretty dramatic 11th hour sort of style, can you describe how this all unfolded once you got to court?
Yeah, well, the worry is that damage awards in British Columbia for nuisance, it was a case of nuisance as well as negligence, and nuisance is interference with your enjoyment of property. Damage awards in BC have been historically pretty low, you know, $40,000-$50,000 for, you know, living with a flooded basement for a year. So that was a concern, is what would the court do with a case like this, where pretty much the plaintiffs, the rest of their lives, I mean, the rest of their retirement would be interfered with, because there's no repairing the problem. I mean, once the trees are gone, they're gone. And so the flooding was going to be a regular occurrence. And so that was a worry. We didn't have any strong precedents, at least in British Columbia, that would justify an adequate damage award. And that's a risk for both parties. It's a risk for us, the plaintiffs, but it's also a risk for the defendant that you're suing. What would the judge do? And so, yes, it is a little unusual. We were on the first day of trial. The judge had flown up. The lawyers had arrived from out of town, and we were about to start. And before we even started, the offer that we had made was accepted. And so that's, you know, it doesn't happen that often that way. Usually you'd, a case might settle on the Friday before court, but here we all showed up, dressed up, ready to go, and it settled at the last minute.
Yeah. Ian, what did they eventually settle for? You mentioned they'll have to deal with some of these issues in perpetuity, possibly more flooding on the property in the future. But at this point, how do your clients feel about this going forward?
Yeah, well, you know, when a case settles, nobody's really happy. Meaning, I'm sure the defendants, the government was thinking, oh, that's a lot of money. Why do we, are you sure we have to do that? And on the plaintiff's side, you know, it's just money. How does that help you enjoy your retirement that you so carefully worked toward enjoying? So the problem is all that a court can really do is award damages. And the very interesting problem for litigants dealing with government is it's impossible for the court to issue an injunction against the Crown. Normally, in a other nuisance case, somebody's flooding your property and they're by diverting some water source, the court can order an injunction to that party to stop doing it, and then maybe you have a chance to recover and enjoy your property again. When the government does something wrong, causing a nuisance, the court cannot issue an injunction. So the only option, the only remedy, sadly, is money. And that is the case for personal injuries generally. If you get in a car accident, there's not much the court can do but award you some compensation. And that is the crux of this type of case. How can you predict what compensation a court might order? It's proper to do your best to try to settle cases before you have to run the whole risk and expense of litigation. And so we came up with a figure that we thought was all right. You know, the figure was $300,000. That certainly sounds like a lot, but when you factor in their loss of enjoyment, the loss of property value, and the fact that it's pretty much permanent for the rest of your lives, that's not very much money. But on the litigation landscape in British Columbia, that is a lot of money. And so we did decide to make this more public because this is important knowledge that the downstream effect of logging a watershed can be very costly to people who live downstream. And you know, the saddest thing is this type of logging may be commonplace. The formula of 30% coniferous trees from a log from a watershed seems to be, at least so far as the government is concerned, thought to be safe. But in the wild, where no one's living downstream, there may well be catastrophic damage like this from even a 30% cut of trees. But no one's there to do anything about it. So this was unusual. There was a watershed where people lived right downstream of it, and they suffered the effects, and they decided to do something about it. The question is, how often does this happen around the province? I can't answer that, but I have a worry that it's, to date, been quite common, and maybe this case might slow that down. That's the hope, and that's the hope of the plaintiffs, who really didn't want this to be that public, but their decision to be public about it is in the hope that our decision making on a logging can be improved.
I know Canadian press initially reported on this, and one thing that stood out was by not going to trial, the government avoids setting a precedent regarding this particular issue. What's your insight as to why you think they wanted to stay away from trial?
Well, why does anyone settle a case? Basically, it's driven by fear, meaning why does a plaintiff settle a case? Their fear, their motivation to settle is, well, maybe the judge isn't going to agree with it the way we see it, and maybe we should just, accept something that's adequate compensation. Why does a defendant settle a case? Same concerns, out of fear. What if the judge fully accepts the proof that we have that this was a catastrophically poorly planned logging operation, and the court awards fair compensation. What if? And so I think the fear is what drove the settlement. Sadly, though, this will not have much precedential, won't have any precedential value in court, at least, because whatever a plaintiff might settle for on a whiplash case just doesn't count for anything, meaning what counts is judicial review and acceptance of the evidence and the proof, judicial finding of fault, and then judicial awarding of compensation in accordance with the degree of harm suffered. So we don't have, this is not of much precedential value, and that's another reason we decided to be public about it, because all that we would have is perhaps some political or policy precedential value, and that's right, because there is harm downstream from all sorts of logging operations, and typically it's just the forest that suffers, or the there's no one around to sue. So we thought this was an important case to make public, and in the hope that there'd be some political policy change.
I guess just a last couple of things for you, Ian. Obviously, you know, this is on one side a bit of a win, settling, getting some funds out of the settlement from the government. But how do your clients feel after the fact? Now, obviously, they're going to have to deal with more of these issues going forward. So, you know, how are they feeling about how this all unfolded?
That's a really good question. You know, they're private people, as I said. This is not something they eagerly would have chosen to be so public about, a very sad event, their loss of enjoyment of their retirement. But there is a phrase that I'm hoping is going to be talked about more often, and this would have come up in our case if we went to trial, and that is ecological grief, meaning the experience of loss a person feels, and it's been academically established as a thing, ecological grief, but it's something court doesn't hear of very often, meaning, yep, your basement flooded, that's too bad, here's some money to compensate you. This is new territory where people carefully chose a wilderness area to enjoy for the rest of their lives, and it's been destroyed, ruined, like not destroyed, but significantly impaired. You know, their enjoyment of it is significantly impaired. What would the court do about ecological grief? So getting back to how the plaintiffs feel about this, they don't feel, you know, some money doesn't make people feel good. It doesn't cure ecological grief. It doesn't at all. So if I'm sure if you ask them, do they feel better? No, this is their life now. And so this is, again, is why they agreed to be a bit more public about this, is that maybe their experience can be attended to by other people who might have had this happen to them. Hopefully it will have some impact. That's our only hope, is it'll have some impact on government decision-making next time they're going to plan the logging of a watershed. They better be extra careful. And I would hope this applies around the province to the wilderness areas as well as residential areas. The only reason this came up is it happened to happen beside people who lived there. And that, I think, is the ecological grief we all should learn to be aware of, is grief is experienced by humans, but it's also experienced by the environment and animals. Suddenly, floods are impairing an area that animals and the wilderness enjoyed. What do we do with that? Who's this is an American concept. Who's going to sue for the wildlife harmed? It's there's nothing like that in Canada yet, but it's emerging in the United States, and I think that's highly appropriate. Who is going to speak for wilderness that's harmed by human activity?
That's the last thing I want to touch upon, Ian, this ecological grief. It's likely we'll see more situations like this in the future. Erosion on properties also been an issue, increasing with climate change. But how do you see these types of cases unfolding in the future as humans continue to have a detrimental impact on the landscape due to their activities?
Well, it shouldn't take much thought to imagine that it's human activity that is worsening the effects of climate change. Climate change may be happening as a routine anyway, as part of our planet's development, but deforestation just speeds that up. And, you know, that is such a simple concept. It's amazing that nobody in power seems to grasp that. So if you're going to cut even 30% of the coniferous trees, you're going to have a catastrophic effect downstream and throw in some periods of heavy rainfall, heavy snowfall, and then higher temperatures that are going to melt all that. Yeah, this is, in a nutshell, a demonstration of what can so easily happen by human development, driven solely by that development. There's a bunch of trees there. It's time to harvest them. You know, it's just called tree harvesting. Well, wilderness is not supposed to be harvested, period. We may choose to take advantage of an abundance of wilderness and convert that into things that we need. We all use wood in our houses, but what's missing is proper planning and prediction of downstream effects when you decide to harvest. These are huge decisions, and they should be magnified in terms of importance during times of rapid climate change, which is where we are. And that's why I'm glad to be talking to you, because cases like this need to be done. Decision makers need to think about what's going to happen downstream. If they just apply the regular 30% should be good, we're fine, let's move on to the next watershed, just take 30% of that, should be fine. No, that can't happen anymore.
Okay, Ian, we'll leave it there for now. Attorney Ian Lawson in Smithers here, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your insight on this case.
You're very welcome, Dan. Thanks.
You've been listening to CICK News. If you have any hot tips or news stories you think we should cover, contact us at CICKnews@smithersradio.com or follow us on Facebook at CICK News. CICK News is made possible by the Government of Canada and the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the only organization mandated to financially supporting campus and community radio stations across Canada. You can also catch our fresh shows each week at theskeena.com or subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks to our producer, Pam Hassan, and all of our roving reporters, I'm Dan Messick. Thanks for listening.